Hello and welcome to Young Minds Matter, a talk show for you and I by the Health Club. You may be wondering, what is you and I? We are a nonprofit, youth-focused organization dedicated to unite and inspire people, especially the youth, to engage in and give back to the community. Applications to join us are now open, so definitely check us out if you're interested. I am Anika Natarajan, the Vice Chair of the Youth Council, and I'll be your host for today. Today is a very special episode because we're celebrating Earth Day. We're diving into sustainability, environmental changes, and why doing our part to take care of the planet matters. And to help unpack all of this further,
as you all have seen, we have our founder and CEO here of United Inspire, Ms. Rajini Priya, and she can talk more about the organization. And then without further ado, we can get started with our special guest, Rihanna. So Ms. Rajini, if you want to explain a few, say a few words about United Inspire, and then we can get hand it over to Brianna.
Thank you. So you have put that in a very beautiful way of explaining them about United Inspire. Well, we have a few, many of our volunteers, the familiar faces here. So they are like here with the example of like what we do is like after the school, how they all come together, showing that unity, inspiring each other to give back to the communities from where they're learning so much and imparting their knowledge, what they're learning in the schools and what they learn here at U&I, again, spreading that knowledge, imparting that knowledge to folks across the communities. So in short, what U&I does is it's connecting the youth to their communities, making bridges in different facets of life, like with the communities, with seniors, with other untapped areas of the communities where they might have not known about. So connecting them to all those corners of the world and making volunteering a learning curve, a learning experience, and also something that they can do with while having fun, also learn and also impart. So that's U&I, and we do it in layered manner, introducing them to the communities. If we introduce them to different causes in the communities through the collaborations what we have with different nonprofits, and then we do little group volunteering or a focused volunteering through special projects that what we do, and also give them experiential learning through the internships, and also we give them a platform for them to come up with their original ideas, like the one that I just described about the podcast and how they have come. So we have those clubs and giving them a ladder to the leadership through the Youth Council. That's where here we are, what Anaga is representing today. So this is U&I, an organization led and focused by the youth and on the youth, for the youth, to the youth. All right, so that's U&I. And our focus age group is from 5 years to all the way 25 years. You can see in Naomi how the little one here, who is very curious to learn from this discussion, to the college student who is chairing the Youth Council. So that's the age range that what you can see. You can see all that here. We have some middle schoolers, we have some high schoolers, and we have college students. How they all come together to make an impact.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that was wonderfully said. I could not put it better. Now moving on to the guest speaker for today, everyone please join me in welcoming Brianna Ferguson, President and CEO of IE Solutions. As part of IE Solutions, Brianna works to steer organizations towards sustainability and environmental safety. She has over 20 years of experience in leading asset management, risk management, design engineering, project management, and regulatory compliance. And now I'll pass it off to you, Brianna. Tell us more about what you do and your journey and how you got here.
Yes, thank you. And it's been an evolution, and I'm very excited to be here and would love to recognize even how I got to be in front of you all. Special thanks to Unique Ventures, Amy Henry and her team for socializing what we do to Dr. Ravi, and then making this new connection. So a big thanks to her, to Again, build networks, build communication, build community. I'm honored to be here. Thank you very much. My background is mechanical engineering. I have a master's in that space. I nearly have a second master's in physics. And I fell in love with the idea of being greener, cleaner, safer, more efficient. I had a great teacher who inspired me in sustainability. And I used to think, what does that mean? And she told me the most sustainable thing in life itself is nature. It's so efficient. It has its cycles. If you go to nature, you look at the natural cycles, whether it's destructive or bringing in, new plants or life just taking place. So she said, that is the perfect machine in space itself. It's just think about how big that is. And she said, when you get into an engineering system, how do you make that more efficient? Well, that's a tiny step. It is time. Maybe you can't do it the whole system, but you can make each piece a little bit better, a little bit better. And the thing that inspired me the most about that is becoming a design engineer in oil and gas and learning how lossy our systems are, right? Meaning we have leaks, pollution, processes that are inefficient. We have, if y'all understand infrastructure, we have engineering infrastructure that goes back in the United States to the late 18, well, actually early 1800s, late 1700s to present day. That means we have so much technology out there, so many processes, and everything in between. There's a lot of opportunity to be better. And because our infrastructure is so large, we do suffer from pollution and leaks and all this kind of stuff. So I'm like, well, how do we fix this? How do we get better? So what I do often is work with a consortium or a community of other small businesses who are also experienced in oil and gas, like me, to be able to make it greener, cleaner, safer for everybody, right? Because we still have to breathe the air, drink the water, put plants in the ground to, get food, name it, right? We still have to live on this earth. And so I'm always inspired. How do we make it better? How do we make it last? We need energy, but can we be better stewards of it? And again, what's the most sustainable thing in life itself but nature? And so I always think about that. It'd be great if we could get to free energy or other types of energy, but that means we'd have to very much wean off of oil and gas. Well, how do we start doing that? By improving our systems and keep making hybrids and keep bridging us along into newer times, other energy sources. But it's not an overnight fix. But how do we do it? Well, you step people along. Would you like a few examples of how we're doing that in oil and gas right now?
Yeah, I would love to hear more about that.
Okay, so for example, again, working in like a community of small businesses, I have a partner of mine who's an inventor of a device that goes into large oil and gas tanks. Have you seen these? They're just ginormous tanks. They're huge. They're several stories high. Thousands and thousands of barrels of products, be it gasoline, chemicals, name what these tanks hold, right? It's dangerous stuff. Yet we need that stuff. Well, in that liquid level, you have a distance between your roof, and then you have the liquid itself that goes down to the bottom of the tank, and then of course it's holding the tank. Well, oftentimes what happens is in this space, you can't fill it up because of safety reasons. You don't want to overfill and come out the top and spill down the side. So we have special technology to monitor the height of the fluid inside of the tank. So what happens now is that we get what we call our volatile organic compounds. And y'all have heard of GHG, greenhouse gases? Yeah. So we want to collect those. And really, what those are volatile organic compounds and CO2 and other gaseous forms, which is namely energy, right? So we capture that wasted energy from the top of those tanks that have these fumes here, and they go out the top and they go out a vapor recovery system, which has leaks. It just is what it is. It's been a design since the 40s they've adopted. So we recover these fumes through a special device that floats on the liquid level. before they get into the tiny little particulates of vapor and go out the thief hatch, which is a vent in the top. It's another word for vent on the top of the roof and through their vapor recovery. Well, that's a lot of wasted energy. So my colleague designed a device to gather it from the liquid level. But then what do you do with that after you've gathered that at the liquid level? Do you send it back to the tank system? And how do you do that? And how do you measure how much of a plume? Are you all familiar with plume? Plume is like a cloud, right? Think of a cloud in the sky, or think of how much exhaust comes out of your tailpipe of your car. And that's like a cloud of exhaust, right? Or your GHGs coming out of your car. Now, you can get special devices to mitigate that and prove, well, my cloud was this big, but now my cloud is this big, right? So, how do you start doing that? Well, that's fun math for me. And I look at that. And if you want to prove that you're an oil and gas person and you're, or a company, and you're trying to reduce your emissions or your GHGs, I want to be able to communicate that effectively through technology and through ways where we're recovering that energy and using it for something else. So we'll recover those VOCs, collect them, and do gas process. Namely, anybody here familiar with thermodynamics, fluid dynamics? So we'll take that, great, and then we'll take that and we'll turn it into another form of energy. Maybe it's fuel gas, where you need to run more of your machinery around your plant, or maybe we can send it directly back to your tank, so you're not sending it over to a flare to be burned off, which is additional exhaust that results in CO2. So we find ways to capture that, repurpose it, and make it more closed loop. Reduce that plume that you see, but that's energy, right? Why are we not using that energy and doing something else with it? So that's one example. And then through that, through the compliance, this is regulations. Are y'all familiar with regulations? Yeah. They're the ones who say you must lower your emissions. You must be more efficient. You must prove how much you're doing. And that's where we have to come in and prove to them these things. Well, this is a great, yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask. So you said your partner developed a device to capture the excess energy in the tank, right?
Yes.
So like how exactly does that device work?
It uses basic thermal principles. So you know how if you're familiar with thermodynamics, you're going to have your solids, your liquids, and then you go through your different phases, right? And general chemistry, right? So when you're sitting inside of a tank, you get vapors that raise off your fluids, and you have different fluids that have sometimes heat requirements, or just by nature you're sitting out in the sun, right? And so you're going to get impacts on that fluid level. So the device sits at this level and basically gathers the larger particulates or the larger molecules before they turn into the tinier mixed phase particles, raising up to the roof and getting smaller and smaller and lighter and lighter. And as they dissipate more and more. And then what happens is sometimes even it'll go up to the roof. And you know condensation, right? How things will get stuck on roof, that will rain back down into the tank. But the finer ones, they escape through the vents. They escape through the VRU, the vapor recovery unit, that's on the roof. But if you're capturing those larger particulate before it even raises up to the roof, you're capturing it at the larger molecule level. So we create a small suction, bring it down through the device, and then bring it outside of the tank and do some gas process to repurpose it. Like I say, either turn it to fuel for other machinery, send it back to the tank. Or if you can run a generator off of it, we can create power for the tank farm for the rest of the facility and take you off of grid power. But that's also tricky too, because you have to understand no two sites are alike. So if you're clear out in West Texas and you have a small tank farm, or if you're in a heavy duty metropolis like New Jersey or here like Houston, and you have a giant tank farm like down in Deer Park, which has loads and loads of tanks, right? Now, if you get to a place like that, maybe that's where you want to generate power, right? So you have to always have engineering and understand what your engineering parameters are, and that's also science, right? We all deal with science and applied sciences. This is a good example, right? It just boils down to math and parameters. So anyway, so I hope that answered your question. We take the thermal dynamic process. We take the larger particulate and then we bring it down through a system and do gas process and turn it into another use. So it becomes a more closed loop versus going out in the air and creating greenhouse gases.
So yeah, you're basically like minimizing entropy while doing so, right?
Yeah, I think that's the way kind of to look at it. And entropy is a good point. And you can do that measurably, right? Because people are gonna, we'll prove it. Okay. So now we're gonna do some fun physics and say, well, or we'll even be simpler. We'll do fun geometry. My cloud used to fit in this geometrical shape. Choose a prism, choose a sphere, and you can do your simple mathematics. It was this big, it was this big. Now you can trend that over time and show what your average pollution would be. And did you guys know that if you're an operator, you by law have to ask the government and pay money to the government to put pollution in the air? Does that sound odd? No? Does it, so basically someone's handing over their data and saying, we're putting this much stuff in the air, and they pay the government money to put stuff in the air. But the ironic thing is, they also have been paying people grants and things like this to stop doing that. So imagine if I'm an operator and I spend millions of dollars every year to have an air permit that allows me to put that stuff in the air. If we reduce that, then that means that their bill should be smaller, right? But I always find it kind of interesting that how can we stop even doing that? Now the tables turn. How are they going to get their money? They being the government, right? So it becomes a strange dichotomy, not to get into politics, but I think it's really important to recognize if they're going to look at those offsets, where can they still continue to thrive as a governmental entity? Just thinking of different sides of the equation, you can say, oh, well, inspections, if they fail their inspections and they're still polluting, they can still be fined. That's true. So just be thinking of always there's a side of an equation and people always having to answer to those sides. But our thing is about efficiency. And if you think also of commodity and you think of numbers, right? Well, money also fits into that situation. There's always a business thing behind it. How much does it cost to get this process working and where did you get the funding for it? Ah, well, funding can come from various places, and funding is kind of interesting because, like you say, depending on how big the site is, or depending on where the money's coming from, so you can get it from different areas. Number one, you can get it through grants for installing innovations. Number two, because there's a drive for this to be efficient, cleaner, safer, and all that. Companies will actually pay you for these projects, and you can do it under R&D, research and development, if you've heard that before. So straight projects, funding, grants, you can have investors once things get a certain way. So in this product development, we've had certain stages we've been able to prove out, but costs vary as prices vary, as sorry, sites sizes vary. So if you have a 5,500 barrel tank versus a 9,900 barrel tank, do y'all know what a barrel is? A barrel of oil and gas? 42 gallons? Yep. So imagine that in one of these ginormous tanks, right? And now you have multiple tanks. And if you're able to recover a certain heating value in with these devices in each system and do the full automation and controls around it to verify and validate and measure, and or do gas process as well, right? That kind of adds up. So I guess you get the idea. A smaller site with six tanks or three tanks versus a larger site with 12, it's going to vary. So I'm kind of waffling on that. It just depends. And further in the environment we're in and economy, the pricing changes. So depending where you get your steel and where it's manufactured, these things all create a landscape which we have to be nimble and find a way to work through. And then those prices change every single year, and especially with inflation. So I apologize, I'm unable to put a finger on it, but I can tell you the devices can range, just the device alone without doing automation and controls is sometimes upward around 35,000 for, we'll just say, the average size device. But then with everything else, that's just a device. That's no bells and whistles of automation controls, instrumentation, electronics, things of that nature. That's not included, right? Now you're looking at installation. Those are going to be people who affix the special device inside of the tank. You have to be qualified for that. So you have to have personnel who knows how to affix fittings, stainless steel fittings, do welding and things of this nature. So now you're looking at personnel, right? And that comes into project management. What are my resources? Well, who's going to do the gas process? Well, that would be us. Do we have to get piping for that? Yes. How many feet of piping? So you have to scope out every single bit of material, every single bit of process of who's going to be doing the activities. And those are all, that's all money. Those are all costs that hit a project. And then you have the software and you have the evaluations, right? And that's yet more cost because now you got to prove it out with the automation and controls. And then at the end of the day, a report, being able to produce a report that you can print out or send it, e-file it with the government or whatever entity, right? So these are all steps along the way and they all cost money. So when you ask me about a cost, I'm like, well, what part? And I'm like, can I pinpoint it on certain parts of the process? Yes, but there are no two snowflakes alike from site to site. So I hope I've kind of answered that. All right. Jay, you have a question.
Yeah, so I just wanted to ask, how was your college experience? Because I also aspire to become a mechanical engineer. So I was just wondering, like, what are some of the things you did in college, how did it go, and what exactly happened?
Well, I love mechanical engineering because by nature, I'm a designer, I'm a drafter. And so I started out in very mechanical space. And then I fell in love with fluid dynamics because everything we were building in design, we'd have like fluids go through it. And so I fell in love with fluid dynamics, even non-Newtonian. So I loved it. Whatever you find a passion, I'll just say I love mechanical engineering because kind of the jack of all trades, master of none. However, you're going to find some areas you connect with more. It might be on the static side or your material side, or it might be in materials chemistry, AKA, or it could get into like your thermodynamics, dynamics, things of that nature. So it's kind of wide open. I loved it. I think the biggest thing is keep practiced in your math and your various areas. Anywhere you struggle in certain math, I'd say the hardest math I had to do because it was abstract compared to like typical geometry, calculus, pre-calc, all those kind of things, right, around the calculus nature, was getting into linear algebra and probability and statistics. So learning how to bridge between different concepts is really a challenge, but stay on top of it no matter how hard it gets. Work with people, stay practiced, ask a lot of questions. If you require extra tutoring and the way I look at it, tutoring is not a bad thing. It's extra practice to overcome some of those hurdles. Because everyone's different. We all connect with certain material better than others. Never feel bad if you need reinforcement in an area, because you're going to be a lot stronger in other areas. That's why I like mechanical engineering. But it's that foundational stuff that sometimes you might need to work with other people. But that's my experience. To be honest, calculus was really hard when I first got into it. And then once I really got a knack for that, the thing that propelled me was being able to visually connect, oh, this is the geometry. This is actually geometry in motion, or this is the area under my geometry, right? Thinking about your calc and your pre-calc, if you can relate it back to physical, tangible things, or that helped me. I love mechanical engineering because I also like things in motion, dynamics. And I think that gave me a foundation to nearly get into a double master's in physics. I went into non-Newtonian fluids, which is really fun too, and that's your charged particles. That's fluids that don't behave under Newtonian physics, right? So this is getting into some quantum physics and kind of how do you manage that, or how do you deal with electrodynamics and magnetism, and how do you control those forces and energy, or make them work for you? So I think follow your passion is what I'm trying to say. Latch onto those things that really light your fire, keep you curious and keep you involved, and stay creative, right? How do you troubleshoot? We solve problems, right? That's what engineers and science and techie people do. What are your thoughts on that?
I think like I completely agree, and also I feel like
Do you like electronics? Electronics are great, having basic circuits, and that's part of a requirement in mechanical engineering. Some people really get great in controls, and then you start crossing over into other disciplines. Now you're working very closely with electrical engineers, but then they need to know, oh, I got to make my mechanism move, right? Or get power out of something. And so you're going to find a lot of disciplines rely on each other and they come together. And that's the beauty of it. You come up with solutions. That's why I like my friend who invented the device to go inside of the tank. Well, let's take that steps further, right? Let's complement it. Let's fill in some gaps or answer some questions will have on how do you prove that, or how do you measure that? Well, that takes it beyond what his device does, right? So we need to make a more complete solution, a fully integrated solution. It's also what I like about mechanical engineering, because you get to see the whole design of the system, right?
Yeah. Thank you.
Welcome.
I have a question for you. How do you think AI will change the role of your company in the future? And do you think, or do you ever plan on integrating it, into
Yes.
your company?
Thanks, Mahika. That's a great question. Yes, AI is a wonderful thing, and it's kind of at its infancy, to be honest. It can be really good. And so you've probably heard AI versus machine learning, right? So we already use that in aspects. And what I look at in that is you need high computing performance for AI to do those advanced algorithms and to learn. But that also takes large computer science. And when people say AI, to me, that's just advanced development and teaching your programs to learn and then keep evolving after that. But you still need people to put those parameters on it. I'm just going to say that out loud. Does anybody here know the difference between machine learning and AI? No? So AI is more artificial intelligence that is available to public. It's more in the public domain. So I prefer when I'm working on my systems to have a machine learning. How is my machine behaving? What are the trends? If I have, we'll pick on a turbine, right, with a big rotor blade. Let's say that big rotor blade over time for a natural gas system wears out and it's turning and turning and turning. But I have data that says if it's made out of this material, it uses this lubricant for running, and or it gets hot, and then we get wear and tear on the turbine, right? Now, if I have data throughout time that says I had to replace this type of turbine blade, I had to go and replace these parts, if I have data to show that, I can teach via trends. We all understand probability statistics in general, right? Yeah, if I can show trends of how that turbine's behaving, now that becomes data from my risk algorithms that I build as an operator saying, performance of this machine. Okay, well, that's a machine. That's going to be based on my system performance, and that's going to be a lot of data. And I have to have proper parameters, which uses kind of like an AI. It's saying, okay, well, if I do this, how do I adjust my performance? Maybe I need to throttle my system or speed it up or have a variable frequency drive and slow it down. Or, there's something I can do with automation controls to counter that. But you can teach your system to do that because how to optimize performance. And this is working inside of a system, which is only privy to that operator, that company, that system that says this is how our machinery or our components of our system work. That's internal. Do I want the public to have this information? Probably not, right? And because that's going to be first operator, this is, I got to control my stuff. But the thing that should be available to the public is we've reduced our pollution. Okay, that's a report, right? That's very specific. Now that report, which should be public knowledge under what we call the Freedom of Information Act, should be out there in the public in some sort of a database that is open AI. And so if you wanted to know what a company A, B, or C is doing, they're supposed to have a report. And you can ask something like ChatGPT, which is open AI. What is that? That's public facing knowledge. Now, AI can also be inside of a company. Well, let's say I have cybersecurity around my machinery because I don't want it to get hacked. I don't want anybody to send something bad and make my stuff blow up or whatever, right? Or anything bad to happen. You'll have cybersecurity around that. But then you'll have your internal company that says, okay, this is AI available to my internal company. Now, that's a different type of AI, but I'm still, as a public person outside of that company, I'm not privy to that. Just know there are different levels of that. And we do use it, and it's just advanced. I don't want to say it's just, it's very important. It's advanced programming.
Yeah, I have a question, by the way.
Yes. Oh,
So
you
it's
still
kind of a question.
have your
Sorry?
I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand up still. I recognize it was still up. I apologize.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. So I have a question that kind of has like two things to it, right? So obviously, electromechanical engineering is heavily incorporated in the applications of environmental engineering, right? But specifically, how often is electromechanical and also machine learning and AI, like you were saying? How often are they applied in environmental engineering?
Well, I think the example I gave is a good idea. Okay. Is a good one. With the device that goes in the tank, and you know how I was talking about a plume, right? Okay, so let's say I have a cool algorithm and I have some validations that measure that plume. Really cool camera, right? You're running that camera 24/7 all the time, right? Okay. Now I'm looking at the cloud and I see a plane go by, or I see a bird. Or a bunch of butterflies. Are those up close or are they far away? Is the system intelligent enough to recognize that that's a plane and that is not part of my plume, right? Let me ask you another question. Do I want all of that data or do I just want the certain measurements? And how do I teach that data? What, okay, let me put another parameter for you. This is why AI is really important in this instance and environmental, okay? Let's differentiate. Is it nighttime sky? Is it cloudy sky? And or is it what else am I seeing in my image? You have to train the image for that particular point and start to trend that. So that's loads of math. Now imagine all that data pushing through there intelligibly. Intelligibly, you'll have to set algorithms through machine learning and AI to be able to say, my plume is this big, and this is how we trended it. This is how we filtered out all the fluff that's not necessary, like planes flying by, right? I hope that kind of helps. Is that a good example?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Good deal. Yeah, Ion. Anaga.
I also think there's a question in the chat. So Sahil is asking, in a general context, if a project is taking more time than predicted, how can we make sure that the stakeholders and investors are still interested and are willing to participate rather than pulling out?
Well, that's a very, very important question. Great question, Sahil. How we typically, excuse me, do this, and this is something good that I recommend for everybody in this space to get used to and learn about, because it never goes away. Y'all have tests, you have multiple classes to take, multiple assignments to do. You have some of these that are priority. One's due before the other, and so on, right? You have to manage that, right? That's managing a schedule. Well, then you have to pay for those classes. And where's that money coming from? Well, you got to work, or it's going to come from somewhere, or maybe your parents have to work. That there's money, right? So you've got your workload, you've got your money, you've got so that's your budget. So what is the task? When is it due? Which is your schedule? Okay, so the task is the scope, right? What is your assignment? Okay, let's scope. What is your assignment? What's the schedule? What are the resources I need to get this done? Do I have to have books? Do I have to go to my classes? Do I have to see a tutor? Do I have to do teamwork on a project? Resources, what's required to get this done? Do I need pen, paper, a computer? Resources, right? Now, what else do you need? Okay, scope, schedule, resources, budget. Okay, and now at the end, what do you have to do? You have to meet all those things, your schedule, namely, and deliver your deliverables. Now, in that, I just gave you five very important pillars, and this is the basis, simple basis of project management. So if you get a chance, I highly recommend you all look at the basics of project management because it's also time management. Now, on this timeline, you have milestones. I've got to finish this test, this assignment, this thing, right? Along this whole timeline, that's your schedule. So getting to Sahil's question, if you don't know how to manage your schedule, your resources, your budget, and any one of these things slide, and you're not in good communication, that's the other thing, having good communication. All right, let's say you miss an assignment. You're late for class because maybe your car broke down, or heaven forbid, somebody got sick, right? Something happened to delay that process. Some things are outside of your control, but you want to be having that responsibility straight away to whatever stakeholder, whether it is the investor who's helping you get the finance to do what you need, whether it's your development of your assignment, if something happened, maybe you ran out of a resource and you need more money. Do you want to find out the day it's due that you need more money or more resources? No, you want to communicate that in advance. The things you know or things that become privy to you straight away, you have to have good communication, and that's going to be the hardest thing. So to answer Sahil's question, manage those five things through project management: scope, schedule, budget, resources. And then at the end of the day, your deliverables, because that's what you need to get across to your client. Think of your teacher as your client, or even you yourself. You have your own expectations. You are a stakeholder. Maybe your parents, because they're helping you get through school or something. There's all these different facets. Those are all stakeholders. So that's how you do it. And you manage that schedule and you keep people apprised of the process of a project. So you're going to know how much your resources are going to cost. That's part of your budget. You know how much time it's going to take. If any of these things are jeopardized, you have to communicate that along the way. And then you go through a process to make a negotiation. That's what it is. It's a compromise to what the schedule used to be. And things happen, you know? If your car breaks down, you weren't able to get to class because you got a flat tire, you drove over something. You're going to want to prove that to your teacher, right? Or something, say, well, no, here's the thing, here's the receipt, here's the date that it was. I was unable to make the test that day. That was outside of your control. But the thing that is in your control is that communication. If you don't follow that, do you think they're going to trust you? No. It's the same thing with a client. Some things happen outside of your control, but some things that are in your control, like a lead time, let's say I had to order a valve. For the one moment, I'll get to you, Parth. So let's say you have a valve, you order this valve, and the estimated time of delivery of that valve is 4 weeks. And I'm tracking the valve on when it's getting here. And let's say that valve is getting delayed, and I'm starting to see, well, they haven't even shipped it yet. And we're already almost time to the point where it needs to be here and we need to install it. Well, I'm behind on that task. I better straight away go to my schedule and see what I can move or how much time I can do, or if I need to communicate in advance that that's a critical piece of the project. If I don't have it, my project will fail. I need to let people know the moment I know ahead of time before that device is or that asset is not installed, right? So that's part. I hope I answered that question for everyone, but I see here. So, Partha, did you have your hand up first?
Yeah. So I had a question. So I was on your website. I was just looking through the services tab.
Yes.
And while I was reading, it had like water and wastewater like under listed. So I was just wondering like what type of things you deal with that.
Yes. So the way I look at a system is similar to oil and gas. It's piping, it's pumps, it's mechanics, it's fluid flow going through a system, fluids being a gas or a liquid, right? And it's very Newtonian. And then also wastewater. What are you trying to do with that water? Are you going to be treating it, or what is the system involved? So it's basically your treatment process. Your system design is very similar to oil and gas, but less volatile, of course, or like dealing with heavy duty chemicals. However, that said, you also have chemical treatment. You have the place where you treat your water and your wastewater, and that requires a lot of monitoring, testing, and measurement, and things of this. So it's very important to look at that whole genre of things. So it's applied physics, really. If you look at one system, what are the similarities? Is it more robust? What kind of danger do we have in these kind of systems? So while the risks may be lower compared to a volatile organic, wait, hang on, an HVL, highly volatile liquid, that means one that has the vapors come out, and if they're exposed to an ignition source, you can get a really bad fire, or based on the rapidity of the combustion, you can even get an explosion, right? So looking at something like this, it's just different levels of risk. Well, if you don't treat that water properly and it goes out into, do you want contaminated water to go to your public for drinking? No. And what level is acceptable to spray on your soccer field or your lacrosse field, right? I mean, there's a lot of different standards to look at. It's still safety. So, I mean, I hope I answered that question. Yeah, good. And Vika, and I'll get back to you, Ayan. Is that cool?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Vika, go ahead, please.
So I meant you mentioned that you're a mechanical engineer major, which I think is really interesting that you can apply that in environmental science. So I was curious, what other kinds of people you work with? Do you work with other mechanical engineers or maybe from different majors?
Yes, so that's a really great question. As we were speaking earlier, I believe I was speaking with Aijan or can't remember now, but we were talking about how sometimes you get a bleed over or a crossover. So in mechanical engineering, you can have like robotics, you can have your mechanisms, but yet you still need automation and controls. Well, that gets into basic circuitry and electronics. So you do have that crossover. When you start getting into thermodynamics and fluid mechanics inside of the mechanical engineering space, you have to have a very good foundation of chemistry and the different phases of which materials behave. I'll say material, any sort of element behaves, right, in a system, in a process, including the let's pick on pipelines, the chemistry of your pipelines. What is the steel your pipeline is made of? What is the fluid going through your pipeline? Well, that's largely chemistry too, because if you have a fluid that's incompatible with the pipeline is going through, maybe you eat holes into your pipeline, right? So there's a lot of chemistry involved. It's all applied science. And if you ask me, it's all about parameters. Environmental is very huge too, right? Where are you building your pipeline? Is it near a river, the ocean, a high population density? Is it near an ecologically sensitive area that is protected by the government or not protected, right? Where is it? And we call these high consequence areas. Now, those are additional parameters. And who gets to evaluate that and say, oh, well, this is a high consequence area based on ecological, the wildlife in the area, endangered species, a sensitive species, a water. Either it's drinking water, navigable water, or it's just part of your fish and wildlife system. Now, there's a lot that goes into that. Well, we have to protect that, right? So I'm going to do my engineering based on what my environmental folks say to say, I'm mitigating that. I'm going to put extra measures for security, redundant protection on my system so I don't release into those sensitive areas. Further, maybe I need to build through that area. That requires special permitting. So I have to, and I'm just telling you all the different disciplines because you asked, Avika. There's so many different disciplines I just named there. So we've got environmental, we've got electrical, we've got our mechanical, we've got our fluids people. Maybe you're just a petroleum engineer and not even chemical, but there's loads of chemical in petroleum. You see what I'm saying? But at the end of the day, I still need to know where I'm going. Where is my pipeline system going? Is it going across our country in an environmentally sensitive area? Now I need to work with those folks to tell me, yes, you are, or no, you're not, or you need to reroute your pipeline to a less sensitive area, right? And now that comes down to risk analyses. Here's another one on environmental. Let's say you're working with civil engineers and environmental engineers. What happens if I have a liquids pipeline, it breaks open and it's going across the landscape? Where is that going to spill and ooze into and create a big pool of bad stuff? Now, those are land evaluations that is very important too. How, if there is a catastrophe, where is it going to migrate and impact things? How do we protect those things? That's all of what engineering is. And when you look at the big system, can one person do that alone? Well, they can, they have oversight, but I need those resources or go down to project management. I'm going to rely on each one of those resources I just mentioned to be able to make a pipeline go through that system safely. And that protects the environment, should. So I don't know. I hope that kind of answered your question. There's a lot of bleed across and there's a lot of dependencies on the various applications. And while maybe an environmental engineer may not need to know all the stuff about my pipeline, but they're still going to need to know how fluid moves in an open landscape and how it'll fill up in certain volumes. Let's say in an arroyo. Does anybody here know what an arroyo is? It's a wash. It's like a riverbed that's empty, like we have them in the desert. And only during monsoon seasons do they ever fill up and transport runoff or water, right? It's very seldom. But the rest of the time, it's just a desert. But that wash, lo and behold, is still a very important environmental feature because it's a land, it's a water body. It's just an empty one, a temporary water body. That makes sense. So I hope those are good examples for you, Advika.
Can I ask a question too?
Ma'am, yes.
So this span of your experience, like what you have just explained about, it has various facets of it. When did you exactly realize that this is the line that you would want to choose, and what made you choose? Like, what experience have driven you towards this?
I think I like the creativity of it, and I have a big heart for Mother Nature. It is the world we share, and I always want to have a good impact on Mother Earth, knowing that we need energy too. And so, how do we create a kind of symbiotic relationship? And will we ever reach sustainability? Respectfully, in my physical lifetime here, I don't know, but we can make those steps towards it and keep teaching and educating because we still have to share this planet, and I'd love for it to last as long as possible. And the more we educate and help people understand, these are all the different pieces that go together. I think that's very telling. So you also asked me, Priya, why? I mean, to be honest, when I came here from Houston, I used to live in Colorado. And it was after a very heavy rainstorm, and I saw the Buffalo Bayou just full of trash. And I just scratched my head, like, why is there so much plastic? And then later down the road, I went out to Galveston and I saw tons of plastic on the beach after a heavy storm because it washes down that way. And I started asking questions like, we can do so much better as people. I mean, number one, plastics come from oil and gas. We all know this, right? Our waste. So I started asking questions about that. We are consumers. And we consume so much, and then we also have energy, which we also consume. We just need to be better stewards of how we use it. And if we're being smarter about our systems and keep edging our way towards cleaner and more efficient systems, those are steps forward. If we can stop some of the overconsumption and waste, which is also GHGs, to me, that's waste. That's wasted energy. Use it, right? And I feel the same about the waste we have. And so that's where I'm like, we have to do better about everything we do. Everything.
Very interesting that you're mentioning about the creative side of it, that what invoked this thought through your observation. So it is, I mean, because often I see that the kids are lost in thinking that the science that what they are learning in the school, or the typical the subject matter that what they're learning in the school, is what will drive them towards a career path and all that. But they often forget that what you just mentioned are the two key areas, the observation to the surroundings around them, and then the creativity in their mindset, like when they're thinking about something or they're looking at something, how you are coming with your creative thoughts, and how can I make it better? How
Yes.
can I make it better? The questions. I think that is what we are like. I really love that, like how you have kind of bridged all those, the connected the dots. And then you placed yourself towards this career path. This is lovely. I want all these kids to understand that aspect of your journey, how you have navigated yourself through your young adulthood years to where you are now. I
Yes.
think that's the question King Shuk had. How did you get to where you are today? What were some of the problems you had to overcome?
Well, I think too is don't be discouraged, because there's going to be a lot of people who are not passionate about the same things you are, or don't see it in the same way you do. And I think for me, keeping an open heart, open mind, and listening and saying, what is your perspective? And learning from that, not fighting. I don't think that's going to get us anywhere. But proving. And I think that was the biggest thing, is when somebody said, if you say this is less expensive or this is more efficient or this or that, show them how. Show somebody how. If you believe and you believe in what you have, show them the difference. And if you can prove it, that's big. But if they're not going to be supportive or anything, channel your energy in how you can prove it. Don't give up. Always believe in yourself, believe in your idea to prove it forward. Learn as much as you can about it. Be open, because when I talk about environment, some people believe very strongly about their ideas. And I'm like, yes, I would love to stop oil and gas today, but it is not going to happen. However, let's see what we can do with what we have, make it better while we continue to transition into newer energy solutions. And I learn a lot, because now I know what this infrastructure is. I know its shortcomings, and I know the good parts of it too. And the oil and gas and fossil fuels, but now we start doing hybrids and or a lot of people call them renewables. I like to call them alternatives, because some of them aren't renewable. It's just another form, right? And there's always an offset. It's a give or take. We'll pick on nuclear, for example. Priya, it's also a water solution, right? A lot of people that in their nuclear solutions, it's water engineering. You take water, you bring it in through your nuclear core, you cool it down, and then you let the water go out, because you have to keep this thermal cycle going to get energy out. Well, that's water. If you're cooler water over here and you let out hot water, well, that's a bad deal, right? Because now you're impacting the environment and all these creatures. So it's always a fluid. There's always an equation. There's always a flow of how the energy is going to come. How you're going to get it from one source, convert it, and change it over into another. And that aftermath is always going to have an impact. And so in nuclear, you have to test your water and say, okay, we're making all these new organisms because the water's hotter than what it typically is, or it's impacting our fish. And now we no longer have these fish. So there's always an environmental aspect of what we do. If we build a windmill, well, that takes loads of energy to make a windmill, right? And you still have to have the oil and the lubricants to turn the blades, and you have to have, well, you need to get the material out of the earth to create the steel to build the turbines, right? And so that all takes energy, and that's an offset in itself. So while you have a ton of energy up front, maybe you have less in the back end, but I also know those windmills are not well maintained, and then they hurt the birds. It's always a give and take. There's no perfect answer.
So you mean to say that equilibrium, what we can bring in in different mechanisms, that what we are bringing together, I think that's the keys, is what you're saying, right? Like, okay, in that sense, like, what kind of occupational hazards you might see when somebody is involved in this as a day-to-day profession, like when they're doing the process and all that. Do you see any occupational hazards, and what kind of an effect of these have it on marine biology?
Occupational hazards, like being exposed to hazard processes, so in oil and gas for sure, there's lots of occupational hazards. You have to wear proper PPE, that's pr protective personal equipment, usually fire retardant clothing, helmets, glasses that protect your eyes, because once something catches fire, the heat is so extreme. If you're in a site that has H2S, which is hydrosulfuric, hydrosulfide, hang on, H2S, I'm trying to remember. Two hydrogens to a sulfide, right? So, and this is an acid gas. So once you breathe it in or it touches a liquid, it becomes an acid. So you do not want it to touch your eye, your mucous membranes, your lungs, anything, because right away it's going to create this acid and it can kill you in a number of like minutes. Just because you won't smell, it'll kill your smell first, and then you won't even know you're smelling anything because you can't smell it, and then boom, no oxygen, gone. It just turns your insides to acids, and it's terrible, it's horrible. So those are occupational hazards. So what we do is we have sensors. We wear them on our clothes when we're in a site that has high H2S, and oil and gas operators have this all the time. So in this solution, for example, where we're mitigating that plume from the top of the tanks, or that cloud, if we're mitigating that, and let's say it's a site that has high H2S, that's how much H2S we're also mitigating that could be escaping into the air. That's one example. Changing those types of hazards reduces those risks for people getting sick. So that's another thing to keep in mind, certain aspects of that. But we face them every day, driving out to a site even, right? On the congested freeway, or driving out to a location, knowing your defensive driving, safe driving, your buddy systems, where are you going? Right? Never go out to a site alone, right? That's another thing. Let's pick on thermal energy. Let's say we're using a volcanic site that heats up the water. You're still exposed to H2S. Did you all know that? Because of all, yeah, you get all kinds of gases that come out of the earth. And if you're using thermal engineering like they do in Greenland, or no, Iceland, excuse me, they have thermal uses there. But that's also a mixture of using your water. Well, that's table water as well. So knowing what you're doing to be able to get thermal energy out of the earth, that also has its ramifications to the table water and the mechanisms you use to, thank you, hydrogen sulfide. Good deal. Good deal. But yeah, so there's so many hazards, and knowing your system and what you need to do, having the right training, occupational training is important. People have been around it before. Safety is huge. Can lose fingers even just by using measurement devices out in the field. So understanding all your handheld tools, moving parts, what's around you in your environment, what kind of clothing you need. I don't know. Did that answer your question, Priya? Good deal.
Great conversation, y'all. It is 6:30, so we're gonna have to wrap up. But thank you so much, Brianna, for being here and for your time. And I hope everyone learned something. I definitely did. So thank you so much. And hope you have a great rest of your day.
Yes, thank you. And perhaps we can do this again. And also, I'd like to share with folks, continue working really hard. And as you continue to learn and grow and find your passions, Priya and I were talking about this earlier, volunteering is good, getting that experience behind you, getting training, getting to the part where you can do internships. I'm very open to have those discussions down the road with you and your team.
Thank you, Brianna. Thank you so much. Thanks for accepting in short notice and being here and giving your precious time to all these students here.
Oh, the honor was mine. The pleasure was mine. Thank you so much.
We'll meet in person for sure, surely soon.
Yes, please. I would love to.
Thank
Okay.
you.
May I ask?
Oh,
Yes. Sorry, go
you
ahead.
too.
Yes, can I ask one more small question, please?
Sure.
So about your company, so does your company try to figure out more ways to help other companies make their processes in the oil company greener, or do you guys also create products like the product your friend made to distribute out to other companies?
Yes. Yes to all of that. So we come together community-wise, come together to provide complete solutions and offer that to oil and gas, as well as complement each other. So if another small business has a skill set that I need, let's say more electronics, and we don't have those resources, I reach out to them to build in a complete solution. So yes.
Thank you.
You bet, Namish. It was a great question. All right. And I know, Ajahn, you had another question. I could take one more, and maybe is it okay? You a couple more questions?
Oh, are you asking me?
Yes.
Yes, I have time. I just wanted to be respectful of your time, so
Sure, thank you.
whatever.
I can go a little longer. How about another 10 minutes or so?
Okay. Thank you for doing
All right.
that.
Yes, absolutely. All right, Ayan, I hope I say your name right. Is it Ayan or Ayan?
It's Ayan.
I love
So
it.
yeah, I
Okay.
appreciate the extra time. I was just gonna ask, are there any upcoming technologies and scientific breakthroughs that will be a major milestone for innovation in your company and engineering and all?
Right. Yes, there's always stuff going on. So your questions on AI, or I think that was Vika's question. I'm trying to remember who asked that before. Advika, right? She asked earlier, I think, on the AI. So there's a lot of changes with coming down the road with AI, machine learning, integration of having smarter systems, low code, no code, more plug and play. But then what happens with, think about this. Every time me and you get a notification to upgrade your phone because of planned obsolescence. Are y'all familiar with planned obsolescence? So they send out updates on these phones to say, oh, your phone is getting old, you need a new one. And what do we do with this? We send it back to the company, either they recycle, refurbish it, or it goes away. Where is away, right? Ask yourself that question. Does it go in a landfill? Where does it go? Does it truly get recycled? This is really important to ask yourselves. Okay, so the reason why I'm getting off on that tangent is because every time we make upgrades into systems, just think about what needs to be changed and where do you dispose of the pieces that are no longer useful. Okay, think of that in the back of your mind. But in that, short answer is yes, we are continuing to integrate and build more efficient systems. And like I said, there's always going to be a give or take, a trade. Understand what that trade-off is and what that big picture of that trade-off is. If you're truly concerned about environment, you think, okay, well, if we make this more efficient on this side, what does that mean? What other additional materials or resources or products do I need to bring in? So we do have innovations every day. There are people looking at hydrogen. Again, it's gas process. Where do we get energy out of something, convert it into another energy, break things off? Well, that requires more equipment, more technology, right? There's always developments in the space. I'd say the biggest one right now, a big thing people are looking at is power generation because of the robust data we're getting with AI and machine learning. And I think the opportunity in that is having smarter AI, smarter machine learning. I'll tell you about this real quick. If you have a whole bunch of unuseful data, what are you going to do with that? Why are we processing on it? We should not even bring that anymore. We should know when to let that go or when to store it and reuse it, right? So that's just a fun question for y'all who are going to be having to dealing with data. So that's an opportunity right there because the more AI we get, the more power we need, or the more intelligence we get and the more products we build. Well, the more energy we need to power that, right? So be thinking about those things because those are trade-offs. So yes, there are innovations coming in, but that means we also need to shift how we're working with energy to do those new things, right? Taking them. Did I answer your question, Ayan?
Yeah, thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you think like people in our generation can like help the environment?
Doing what you're doing right now, seriously, and staying inspired and finding ways to influence and come up with ways to be greener, cleaner, safer, more efficient, building those communities and working hard to bring out solutions, measurable solutions, I think, and staying inspired. And even if you don't come up with an idea, that's okay. Maybe we all come together on someone else's idea that's a really good one, and everyone's like, this is working. Let's support that. So, if I can say anything, continue to be a support in your community. Keep learning of how you can stay active in it and what drives your passion on how you want to contribute.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
My biggest takeaway from this conversation, this question and answer session, is that observation. The key point at what you said about what you observed what's happening around you and that and it led you to where you are today. I hope these kids learn that and they take that along with them today and from their observations what they would see henceforth. I'm hoping that that will inspire them to come up with a few more innovative ideas or team up with someone who is working on it
Yes.
and be the change makers.
Yes. And I love the word you used is team. It's not about who's the fastest or the bestest or the richest or all this kind of stuff is always going around us, right? So long as we come together, we complement each other and everyone leverages each other's strengths. I can't remember the saying and I'm gonna do terribly by trying to say it, but I'll give the example. To lift a boat, to lift a ship, right? Let's imagine a few people trying to lift a boat, right? It's hard to lift a boat with just a few people, but if you have many, many hands, it becomes like a wave, right? And if we have all these people, now imagine the ocean, all those waves, people supporting this ship. So that's, think of the ship as the idea. Everybody supporting it, you become like the waves carrying the solution. I love that. I can't remember who it was. It was some leader from somewhere, but they were so right. They couldn't do it. Well, I have a ship, but I can't carry the ship myself, right?
Right. I
Yeah.
can see I can see the creativity, the visual creation that what mental picture what you can give. You're just so creative, Brianna. Like that's the second takeaway for me. Be creative and be observant.
Yes. Troubleshoot, troubleshoot, and come together.
Yes. Well, any last questions?
Navomi, do you still have a question? Your hand is still up.
Yeah, I just forgot to lower it.
Good deal, good deal. Well, I'm so glad. Did we get everyone's questions? Everyone get everything off their minds for the moment? And maybe we can have a part two another day.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you so much, and thank you for staying an extra 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I know all of them had a lot of questions, but I'm really glad that it was engaging and people were asking questions. But thank you so much. It was such an inspiration to hear from you.
Likewise, it's inspiring to me to see so many people engaged and wanting to learn more in this space and contribute in this space. It's inspiring to me, and it gives me hope. It really does.
Well, we hope to reach a few more through our podcast, like the when our podcast releases the ideas that what you shared and the questions what these youngsters have put to you. We hope that it inspires a few more through that. And we also hope to have you come and be our guest speaker to a larger audience sometime soon.
I would love that. Okay, sounds good. Let's stay connected, everyone, and appreciate this wonderful opportunity. Thank you so much.
Good.
Thank
And
you.
thank you, Anika, for thinking of this kind of a session in the Earth Week, and quite a what a meaningful one, and what a connecting one, and profound. The profoundness in this knowledge sharing that what we have had, it's very, very inspiring. So thank you for doing that.
You're
Thank
very
you.
welcome. I'm really glad it worked out. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Reach out anytime. Thank you, everyone.
Thank
Yeah,
you.
thank you, everyone, and see you also.